Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on April 26th, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Good evening, I'm Bruce Goldstein, and it's my great pleasure to welcome a great guy, the director of The Incident, Larry Pierce.
Thank you.
Exactly 50 years ago. This was only your second feature film.
Yeah.
And the first one was made 4 years before, got a lot of attention.
Yes.
One Potato, won a Best Actress Award at Cannes for its leading actress, Barbara Barry. So what took so long to make your second feature, 4 years?
I guess, truthfully, I had to learn how to direct. I started as a live television director, nothing very fancy. I worked for a local television station in California, like I guess your Channel 5 used to be here. It was an independent station, and I worked there for 2.5 years doing live shows. Nothing very fancy, car commercials, banging the fenders, those kind of things, and country, western, any way to earn a living. Anyway, I then went off and did One Potato. That was a long story in itself, and we financed it and did it here in New York. We shot it, actually, in Ohio. And then I finished the show. We took it to Cannes, and Barbara won the Best Actress Award, and we got accolades, people yelling and shouting and all that. And I couldn't get a job for a year. Nobody would hire me. And finally, my agent got me a job directing a film television show with, who was it, Chuck Connors, doing Branded. This was after he did Rifleman. And I did, in a 2-year period, I guess I did 20 or 25 half hour, an hour dramatic shows for television. Run for Your Life, Wild Wild West, Batman,
six
Green Batman. Hornet.
I did six Batmans,
right. Anyway.
Julie Newmar episodes?
I got Victor Buono, who weighed 400 pounds.
Oh, Victor Buono.
King Tut. But anyway. I did learn my craft.
You said the Green Hornet.
Yes.
So you directed Bruce Lee.
Yes.
It was pretty cool.
He was difficult communicating with. His English was very limited at the time. It got better, obviously. But anyway. But because of that, I really learned my craft, because the making of this film was an extraordinarily complex, technical film. This is all shot in a car in a studio in the Bronx called Gold Medal Studios.
Which was where Car 54, Where Are You, was shot.
Right, amongst
the
other
Biograph
things,
Studios.
Biograph, and it was an old silent film place. It had a glass ceiling covered by a regular ceiling, but the glass ceiling was still there when we shot. And it was an inordinately complex film. And if I hadn't had that 2 years to learn my craft, if you will, it would have been almost impossible for me to have made 2-Minute Warning.
You were born and raised in New York.
Born in the
Real
Bronx.
Real New Yorker. Your father, famous opera star later, Jan Pierce.
Right.
We were just together in Hollywood at the TCM Festival.
Right.
With two of the other actors, by the way, Martin Sheen and Beau Bridges.
And you
all look amazing, by the way. I don't know how did that happen. And I asked you in that interview whether you thought a non-New Yorker could have made this film. And what did you say?
I thought it would have been extremely difficult.
Oh, you didn't say that, actually. Oh. You said, yes, I don't think a non-New Yorker could have made this movie.
I think it would have been, I think you had to pick up the pulse of the city and the feeling of the city and our neurotic fears about certain things and attitudes about things from the 60s, for surely, when I made the film.
And this came in wake of the Kitty Genovese case.
Yes, it did, absolutely.
Although the original TV play came before that,
yes,
Ride with Terror.
That's right.
It came before the Kitty Genovese case.
That's right, evidently, but the film came after. And actually, I did a small thing to, in essence, make mention of the Genovese case. When they take the man who's mugged into the alley, and it happened too quickly, it never really could register, because I didn't make anything out of it. But what happened was, there were lights all over the backyard when they take him in to mug him. And what happened was, as they heard the yelling and whatever went down, what was going on with the two guys mugging him, all the lights went click, 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 and they went out. Everybody disappeared in hiding while this was happening. But that was as far as we got.
This was made just after Mayor Lindsay established the mayor's office for film. So you did get cooperation?
We did. We got cooperation from the... He had established a thing called the Tactical Police, I think it was called. And they were a police force, and they were basically to help us make films. They weren't much help. And where we were shooting in the Bronx was not one of America's great garden spots at the time. It was a very tough area. We were on where the pool hall was. It was Tremont Avenue. And it was one of our first nights shooting, and I remember I was outside, and I hadn't lived in New York for a long, long time. And so we were out there, and we were setting up a shot, and I heard popping, and I said, firecrackers? What kind of firecrackers? This isn't July 4th yet. And with that, the key grip picked me up and threw me down on the ground, and a car went by, and the police car, I was like a Western, pow, 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 they were shooting at each other. So it was quite an exciting experience. But the police didn't do anything. They kind of stood back.
So you kind of answered this. I was going to set you up for this. No. How did you get permission from the transit authority? And the answer is you didn't.
We never. They wouldn't. They refused to give us any help at all. Actually, they denied that anything could happen on the subways. They said no. But, you know, that's the way life is. And they absolutely denied it. And they absolutely refused to let us on the subway system at all. So any shots that we got with the subway in are all stolen. In other words, everything is cheated. All of those plates that we used for the inside of the subway when you see the stations going by and all of that, that was all stolen. The cameraman, Jerry Hirschfeld, shot that out of a suitcase and a box with a hole in it, banged up against a window getting those plates. And they couldn't stop us from having the actors go up. They had to let them on because they were just citizens, and if you had whatever it was, a buck in your pocket, you were allowed to get on the subway. But we weren't allowed, so that we were only allowed to be off it. We couldn't impede them in any way, so that we shot from towers, from cranes, from tops of roofs. All of those shots are all stolen shots, if you will.
How many of you thought that was a real subway car?
No. Did you?
Really? I mean,
it's an exact replica, but it's down to about three quarter size.
Thing in that car I've never seen. The little area in the back where he was arrested.
Oh yeah, that was.
Have
there.
You seen that?
Oh,
there
yeah.
was,
oh,
you and bet. Then I remember the wicker
seats,
but they were facing each other.
They were
in
facing
some cars.
Each other. It depended on which line you were on. If you were on the IRT or the.
Let's
BMT.
Take a look at the car again. Okay. There's a great shot. I love this shot. It takes. It starts on the platform and goes into the car. I mean, this is an incredible camera work here. So we're on the platform, and the camera looks into the car. This is not the restored print you just saw. You could see that. This is off the Fox Movie Network, actually. Also, one of the stations were also sets.
They're all
and they
sets.
Were pretty good.
Yeah, they were. They were very, very good. The cashier's booth, the station where he made this, where Gary Merrill speaks on the phone, that was all a set that
and
we
the,
built.
And the one with Brock Peters,
yeah. Yes.
Which is Mount Eden
yes.
Avenue, it's
That's,
supposed to be.
Yeah.
Let's look at that.
Okay.
It looks pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
If you look at it closely, the floor is too littered.
Well,
yeah, maybe.
But a production is
there are still stations that look like this, I
oh,
think.
Oh, yeah. And just as dirty.
And one of the things I love about this movie, one of the many things, is that it's geographically correct, right?
Yes, it is.
I mean, you wanted to get that right.
Yeah, we did. We got it every station. You know, the train started at 241st Street in White Plains Road and ends up all the way down at Grand
Central. I happen to have a 1967 subway map right now, and I want to show you that how accurate this is, how accurate this movie is. You don't see this a lot in movies. So here's a 1967 subway map as seen in the movie. I'm guessing that Jack Guilford and Thelma Ritter got on at Woodlawn. Ed McMahon got on a Moshulo Parkway. And then I think Jan Sterling and Mike Kelling got on a Burnside Avenue. And then Gary Merrill and Robert Fields at 176th Street. Brock Peters and Ruby Dee at Mount Eden Avenue. And I'm guessing that Sheen and Musante get on at 170th Street, and they go all the way to Grand Central with no one else getting on,
no.
except for the two women who wanted to get on at 125th Street.
My grandparents lived at 170th.
Oh, is that why?
On Finlay, no, not oh, no. on Finlay Avenue, off on the other side of the Grand Concourse.
Let's talk about the amazing cast. This is the most amazing ensemble cast I've ever seen. First of all, the debuts of Martin Sheen and Tony Musante and Ed McMahon.
Oh, yes.
Can't forget Ed. He's fantastic, isn't he?
He was really very good in the film.
But how did you find Martin Sheen?
I don't know.
But, you know, he was on Broadway at the time, and the subject was Losey, which is also a Bronx family,
even though
he was from Ohio.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And we just found him with the casting, you know, the usual casting directors bringing actors in, and he was terrific. And that's, you know, it was... Went through a lot of actors and different actors, and we just, it worked out. It was kind of an extraordinary ensemble and a mix of all kinds of people, all kinds of actors from totally different schools of acting. You had very modern people who studied at the Actors Studio at that time, then considered, you know, the whole avant-garde feeling. And then you had people like Thelma Ritter, who certainly was anything but that.
This was her last film.
She was an extraordinary person, a wonderful person, a wonderful actress, and so giving and so free. And she lived in Forest Hills. I remember I had to go out there and bring the script to her, and we talked. And she said, yeah, I think I'll do the movie. Okay. And she said, you know, I don't know anything about all this modern stuff. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, you know, I know the actors. You got people in there from the Actors Studio and the thing. And she said, but I'll go along with anything. And she did. And as an example, the scene where she and her husband confront him and she slaps Tony, that happened in an improvisation in a rehearsal. That's where that came from. That was not in the script, had nothing to do with it. And just out of her, this whole emotional thing, and she said, I never did an improvisation. I don't even know what you're talking about, but let me try it. And we got into this rehearsal and she got into it and slugged him, and that the energy of the scene was extraordinary, and the dynamic amongst the three of them was absolutely fantastic. And that came, and Thelma was that kind of dame. She said, I'll try anything, and she did, and we got a wonderful piece of film as a result of it.
And our friend Tony Musante, his first film. Tony, by the way, lived right around the corner from here on Bedford Street. He was here a couple of times. How did you find... Well, he was in the original.
He was in the original. He was the only only actor that was brought over from the original.
He was one scary mother.
He was a scary guy. Yeah.
Not in real life. He was a lovely guy in real life.
He was just a sweetheart. He was, you know... Actually, when we did the... When we finished the week, we had a week of rehearsal. And in the rehearsal period, we worked with each grouping. The husband and wife, you know, each of the groups of the two guys... And then with the last part of it, we would bring in the two boys, and they would have work. And then we did the whole week of that. And then on the last day, we did a mass improvisation in a rehearsal hall, set up chairs and set up the, in essence, the car. And we sat there, and I said, we're going to do this, and we're going to see what happens. And I don't know how many of you know about improvisation. I'm sure you got a couple actors here, some guys who studied, I'm sure. Anyway, we started the improv. And it didn't work. And my feeling was, if it didn't work and the people in that car, those actors, couldn't understand the intense fear that would mesmerize them and lock them to those seats and not let them move an inch while all of this horror was happening, wouldn't work. And so, but before the scene started, Tony and Marty came to me and said, Larry, we want you to go in and tell the people that we're really nice guys. I said, they know you're nice guys. Come on, we're all professionals here. No, Larry. So I went out and said, they're really nice guys. And they said, we know they are. We started the improvisation, and it was nothing. Nothing happened. It was boring, and it went on for about 20 minutes. And I said, oh, my God, if this doesn't work, the film is not going to work, in my opinion. And suddenly, Tony honed in on the Brock Peters character in Ruby Dee, where I knew he had to go. And he went there and started. And that moment when Brock stands up in the car occurred in that rehearsal hall. And he stood up with this rage coming out of him that was so extraordinary. And I ran across the room and we grabbed him and I held on to him and we stopped. And I said, that's it. We're done. you all understand what happened in this car? And they were all sitting there like they were at the end of the film, nobody moving, and nobody got up and lit a cigarette until they were all sitting there. And I said, now you understand where you are in this film and who you are and what you're doing. And let's say goodbye, and I'll see you on Monday. Boom. And that was it, and that's how we started the film. So it was an extraordinary experience. The whole film was I don't know, you can't say a love-in. Films are not a love-ins, you know. They can be very, very, very difficult. Truffaut had a marvelous story. He likened the making of a film to a stagecoach ride. You get on the stage, I'm sure some of you have heard the story, you get on the stagecoach with great anticipation, looking forward to a very pleasant and wonderful journey, and by the time you finish the 3 or 4 or 5 days in this trip, you're only thanking God you've arrived at the end of it. And that's usually the making of the film. This film, on the other hand, was not like that at all. It was an extraordinary marriage of people coming together to work, as I said, all from very disparate skills and attitudes, and we ended up making, we thought, a pretty good movie.
And so many other great people in this film.
They are.
Mike Kellen.
Wonderful.
Ruby Dee. Brock Peters. Who else? Gary Merrill.
Yes. Sterling.
Sterling. And the actor named Robert Bannard.
Yeah. Well, he plays, you know.
Yeah, because he happens to be here.
Is he here?
Yeah.
Where are you?
He was.
Hey.
Bo Bridges. Friend.
Both of us.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
There are only four of us left.
I know.
You want to say something about making the movie?
The first thing I'd like to say is this film was so impactful at the time, and it was really something that wasn't good for me. Walking down the street 3 or 4 days after the film, and a construction worker across the street yelled out, "Coward!" And this happened more than once.
Oh, boy.
Happened more than once. It wasn't who I was, by the way. That's not who I was.
No,
in the film. What I'd like to say about Larry and a couple of things that were so unbelievable. I wouldn't have gotten this part if it wasn't for Larry. He probably doesn't remember this, but I went up to, I think they, did you cast it Biograph?
Yeah.
You were casting it Biograph. I went
we
up there.
We did part of it on 57th Street.
Okay. But when I went up there, was going to be originally cast for the Vic Arnold part.
Right.
That didn't work out very well. And I thought, well, I blew another one. I hadn't worked very much, and I thought this was some film I really wanted. And as I walked out and was getting my clothes, Larry ran out, and he said, by the way, would you like to read for another part? I said, sure, yeah. He said, I think this might be right for you. He gave me the script. I was out there for a good half hour, maybe longer. I went through the script over and over and over, and I'm thinking, oh, you know, this might be a part for me. Nobody else was left. Larry comes out. He said, Come on in. The producer, everybody was in that room. Everybody. I mean, like, there must have been 8 or 9, 10 guys out there. We started to read the script, and Larry, about a quarter of the way in, he stopped me. He said, well, wait a minute. He said, well, you know the script pretty well, don't you? I said, yeah, I know the script pretty well. He said, just put it down, and don't read with a reader. Read with me. And it just took off. I mean, I felt relaxed. He was there for me. I felt relaxed. The whole scene just flew. And he said, can you wait outside? I said, sure. Went outside and sat down. He came out about 10 minutes later and said, you got the part.
I don't remember
also,
that.
Well, I also will say something else. It was one of the greatest experiences I ever had with an ensemble cast in anything I've ever done. And the reason was Larry. And I'll tell you why. There are certain directors that are actors would consider safe. Actors considered someone that they trust, someone that gives them a context of being able to work in a friendly, even a fun atmosphere. I think of Elia Kazan. I auditioned for him 3 or 4 times. I never got the part, but he was an actor's director. Mike Nichols, I never worked with him. I hear he's kind of like that too. This is the guy that put that thing all together, and he put it together because he gave the actors such a safe place to work in that it was just extraordinary. So he's an incredible director.
It was an extraordinary experience for all of us involved. It was very, very weird. It was weird. Making a film is not an easy experience. Some can be wonderful, some cannot. I made a couple of films that were great experiences for me. One Potato was a wonderful experience. Goodbye Columbus was a great experience. Yeah. Some of the others, I don't even want to talk about. They were very unpleasant. This film was a memorable experience. And also, that nobody seems to talk about, but I'm sure you remember, we ran out of money after the first week of shooting. We started shooting all of the exterior scenes that lead up to them getting on the subway. The mugging, the two boys at his mother's and parents' house, and them walking and talking and up on the subway. We shot all of that before we were ready to go into the subway car. And then we shot that, which was a wonderful experience, again, in making a film, which is very rare. We shot in sequence inside that subway car from the minute they got on till the minute everybody got off. It all stayed in one piece. And it was magical. It was hard to understand it, but we ran out of money. Our check started to bounce. I'll never forget. My agent called me, and I was living in a hotel in Midtown, and said, the production manager called and said, Larry, don't rush, because we used to look at dailies, because we were night shooting. We'd come in at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, look at dailies, and then go out at night and shoot the whole night. He said, take your time coming in today. I said, what are you talking about? He said, you get in here a little later. I said, what about dailies? He said, don't worry, dailies. I didn't know it. All our checks had started bouncing, and we shut down. Boom. And then we held for, what, it was over a month.
Yeah.
It took over a month. The whole cast stuck together and held on, and we went out and raised the money through 20th Century Fox, David Brown, Zanuck Brown, the famous production company, and he sent the script to Dick Zanuck in California, and I flew out with that film that we had shot, already edited, and brought it out and made a deal and came back, and we started shooting the film, and the whole cast stuck together and held on until we made the movie. It was quite an experience.
If you don't mind, I'd like to tell a real quick story about one of my favorite times on the film, very short. Off the set, which was the subway car, all the actors would kind of gather when Larry was directing certain scenes. And the person in the cast, besides Bo, which I spent a lot of time with, but the person in the cast I liked the most was Thelma Ritter. She just was so real and so genuine. And I would sit down next to her, and she would sit there very quietly, and she would knit. And she wouldn't say a word. So at one point during the filming, midday or sometime, well, a couple of other actors came over. Bobby Fields, I remember, was one of them. Tony might have been one of them. But there were three or four different actors sitting around her. And all of a sudden, of course, the subject got to acting. And Bobby Fields was from the Actors Studio and Stanislavski and all of that stuff going on. And, of course, Thelma was just rolling her eyes. And we started talking and talking and talking. And then we noticed that we were leaving Thelma out of it. Well, Thelma, what? Somebody brought up Clark Gable. He said, you did The Misfits back in 61, 62. She said, yes. Clark Gable. He was well known then and very attractive actor and everything. And so people started talking about Clark Gable. Bobby Fields chimes in. Well, you know, he was just, you know, good looking guy and, you know, didn't have much internally going on. And there wasn't that emotional thing going on. You know, he was just, Clark Gable, good looking guy, all of that. And then finally he stopped talking. He said, well, Thelma, what did you think about Clark Gable? There was a long pause. She looked up at Bobby Field and she said, well, I don't know about Clark Gable being just, you know, that kind of an actor, but I'll tell you one thing. Clark Gable played one hell of a Clark Gable.
That would be her. That's terrific.
Thank you, Robert.
Good to see you. Thanks. Good to see you.
See you in a minute.
We have time for a few questions from the audience. Where's the mics? Well, they're right over there. Wait for the mic, please.
I was living in Italy in 1968, and one night my friend said, well, which movie do you want to see tonight? And I said, I don't care as long as it's not violent. And he insisted on taking me to this film, and it was dubbed in Italian, but they had changed the title to an English title, which was Violence. That was the title in Italy.
It was
violence.
No, it was, I remember it was New York or a train. New York at 3 a.m. That's what I remember.
Right. Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
In Greece.
Uh-huh.
1968.
Yeah.
New York, 3 a.m.
Am I right? Then I remember it. Okay.
That's right. I saw the poster. Yeah.
Yep.
In fact, because of this movie, Tony got a lot of work in Italy.
He ended up working endlessly in Europe as a result of it and did very, very well. Made his whole career really making most of his films in Europe after that.
I first met him, had him here when we did a Spaghetti Westerns Festival. Over here?
Hi, thank you for the film. Could you tell me just a little bit about Ed McMahon? I guess he was already on.
Johnny Carson's sidekick?
Yeah, for 5 years, and was this his only movie?
More than that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You mean tell me about what, as an actor?
Like, how'd he find his way into this film? It seems kind of out of context.
You know, in a sense, we used to call what happened using Ed McMahon in the parlance, as I remember it, of the business, was called stunt casting. You cast somebody who's rather well-known and famous and hope you can get a performance out of them. And Ed was a wonderful guy, and we met and we talked, and he was funny and glib and charming, and he was, in essence, when I walked away from it, I really figured he would be perfect for the film. He's an Irish-American, and who else could you see but this big guy making $105 a week working for Gibraltar or one of those companies, you know, as a bookkeeper, an accountant, and it ended up perfect casting in terms of us, but it was a difficult experience for him, as you can imagine. It was something he wasn't used to, and especially the looseness with which we all filmed. Bob will tell you, a lot of stuff was improvised, and some of it wasn't, but he had a lot of lines, as an example, when Tony is over there terrorizing the child, and he's holding the child. The script called for him to say an enormous amount of stuff. Don't touch my child. You touch that child, I'll kill you. You know, all this kind of stuff. And I didn't believe that was what somebody would do if they were terrified and scared to death. And so I didn't know what to do, but I came up with an idea, and I talked to the young woman, Diana Vandevlis, who played his wife. And I said, Diana, what would you do if your husband was running off at the mouth and you were terrified he was going to get killed? She said, I'd stop him from talking. So I said, every time he opens his mouth, put your hand over it. And that's where that whole piece developed. And Tony, we brutalized the poor man. Tony almost choked him to death with that. You know, it became a reality for him, and he was able to handle that and did very well with it. The stuff when he walks, when he's walking and talking, he was terrific. He was playing who he was, and it became a real moment in the film, so he worked out really well.
He's terrific in
he
it,
is
actually.
Terrific in the movie. He's great.
He's a real shit. Ironically, the person who used them after you, yeah. Ted Kotcheff, right. Will be here Monday night.
Oh, my goodness.
He used them in Fun and Dick and Jane.
Oh, there you are.
Wasn't quite as good in that.
No, well, he was...
Yeah, this is perfect.
Yeah, this was a perfect role for him. New York, a street guy, you know, a guy with probably a high school education. It was a perfect marriage of a character and a human being.
Over here, anybody? Oh, there.
A great subway movie. I think Taking a Pelham 1 wouldn't have been made without this film. But I was going to ask you how you got Donna Mills, and the second question is how come this hasn't been on DVD, and hopefully it's going to come out soon.
Well, that's a thing. How we got Donna Mills, she was brought in the same way in a casting call. She was here in New York. She was a young kid. She was, again, and she'd been trained and worked. She started as a dancer, and we met her here in New York, and she was this very pretty young kid. Lovely Catholic kid from Chicago. And again, I said, oh boy, she read and she was interesting, and I thought it would work out great, and it did. That's how. And
that was her debut too, right? That was her debut film.
I think that was her first film. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. And why there's no DVD? We got caught in a funny thing. The film we opened in whatever it was, afterwards, when they finally decided to put it out, Fox was not making DVDs. They were doing the old disc. The laser disc. And they brought it out on laser disc, and laser discs flopped. And as soon as they flopped, we disappeared into the firmament, and nobody ever made another try at it again, and that's why we ended up the way we ended up. That was what happened. I wouldn't be very nice.
Be
somebody
nice.
Told me they're going to make a Blu-ray of it.
Oh, well, that might be something like Twilight Time, one of those
maybe, yeah, exactly.
Boutique companies.
Yeah, one of those kind of things.
Speaking of Pelham 123, which I love.
Oh,
it's
I love
a, it's, there are two great Subway movies as far as I'm concerned, but Pelham really does rip this off a lot. They're even on the same train line in Manhattan. That's true. Same premise. They even Pelham even has a drunk falling down at the end. So many things, so many ideas taken from this movie.
Well, I don't know.
But anyway, we're showing that in July.
The director and I were old buddies and old friends.
Joe Sargent.
Joe was a, may he rest in peace, was a fabulous director and a fabulous guy, and he made a terrific movie.
It's a great movie, great cast. Another great ensemble cast.
Yes, indeed.
Another cross-section of New Yorkers.
You're absolutely
they added
right.
a cross-dresser, though.
Yes, yeah.
Over here.
Yeah. This was a great movie. And speaking of another great movie, I just realized All About Eve, Thelma Ritter, you've already talked about. Could you talk a little about Gary Merrill in this movie? In your movie, The Incident.
Yeah,
he was in All About Eve, as you know.
He was a very interesting man, and he was a very wonderful man. And he was and he's terrific in the movie. He had a lot of problems, Gary. And he was, I don't say things about people, but he had a serious drinking problem, Gary, and it affected his whole life and destroyed him, finally. And sober, he was the most marvelous man in the world, hardworking, serious. But when he'd start belting that booze, it got very unpleasant. And he started some serious drinking. When we quit, when the show went down, and we had no more money, and trying to hold a cast together is like trying to herd cats. You can imagine, guys have jobs they're going to. Someone, I've got a movie starting, I'm going to go on in a play, I'm going on stock. I'm trying to hold a cast together for a month or 6 weeks while you're trying to trying to pick up money. Everybody's stuck except Gary. Gary said, I'm out. Well, there was a big problem. We didn't have enough money, no matter what, to recast the part and have somebody else do it, and he was terrific. We'd seen the stuff. I had shot the stuff in the bar and the stuff in the subway station. That stuff was all done. And he said, I'm not doing it. So I got on a plane, and I flew to Portland, Maine, where he lived. And we sat. He said, what do you want? I said, I'm here to talk to you about the movie. And we started an evening of drinking. That was, oh, my God, it was unbelievable. I enjoy a drink, and I've always enjoyed it. I'm not this guy. We were drinking steadily from 5 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the afternoon until 6 o'clock the next morning, and I was standing there out of my mind. I talked for hours, talking. And finally he said, oh, all right, goddamn it, I'll do the movie. And I said, oh, thank God, and I fainted, fell on the floor and passed out. So, that's a true story. So after that, he was fine, but he was a wonderful man. He really was.
Time for a couple of more. Back there. All right.
Thanks, Bruce. I get the impression that you attracted to the ensemble cast, of the ensemble nature of the screenplay. But on the premise that there were other good ensemble, you know, screenplays going around when you were picking your movie, why did you pick this particular one? I mean, it is a very quirky movie. Some might be put off by the violence or the creepiness, psychopath nature of it. Why? What attracted you to this particular script?
Well, just caught me with something. I have a serious problem in my life. I was a guy. I could never make my mind up. Do I want to do it? Don't I want to do it? I could tell you, my wife is sitting back there smacking her head now. And I say, movies I've said I would do and then walked out of, movies, you know, I should have done and didn't, all that kind of stuff. And this movie, my agent then was a famous agent. He wasn't that famous then, but he was an agent named Sam Cohen. And he was my agent, and he called me. I'm in California. He's here. He said, Larry, I'm sending you a script. I want you to read it. I think it's terrific. I said, oh, good. I'd love to read it. And he said, read it. I read it. I called him back. He said, well, I said, it's a really terrific film, Sam. I think it would make a really terrific movie. He said, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, and I started, well, I don't know. On the one hand, I think on the other hand. And he finally said, listen, you son of a bitch, you're going to do this movie or I'm going to kill you. And I said, Sam, for God's sakes. And that's how it really propelled me into making the film. And then it became one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life. And sitting here talking, listening to Bob Bannard, and it all brings back all of this kind of stuff that was, it was just a perfect marriage of material and all of us involved. It was an extraordinary, extraordinary experience.
Was Sam eating paper in those days?
Pardon me?
Sam Cohen. Didn't he eat paper?
I saw him do that one.
Paper,
he'd eat paper. Oh. You know, it was,
it's a, you'd have to see it to believe it. Yeah. One more? One more. Great question.
First off, thank you, Larry, for tonight's great movie. Was it your choice to make the movie in black and white?
Yes, it was all our choice. We shot tests in color, and it just didn't work for us. We did all kind. We shot some tests in color and black and white, and Tony had a bridge that came out, and he didn't have three or four front upper teeth. He said, "How would this look?" I said, "I don't know. A little wild." So we tested him. It was horrible. You looked at the screen, it looked like he had a 4-foot hole in his mouth from one side to the other on a close-up. So we decided not to do it. But we just felt that the film belonged in black and white. It was a black and white film, and Fox agreed. They could have made us reshoot if they'd wanted. It wouldn't have cost that much to reshoot the week of shooting, but they liked what they saw, and that's how it ended up as a black and white film, and rightly so. Those are the, I did two black and white films, my first one and this one.
Was this the last film in black and white that Fox released?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I think it was.
Does anybody know? It could be.
Whose idea was Tony's sideburns? Was that his idea?
Who knows? You know, that's, now you're talking 50 years ago. Yeah. I've got a pretty good memory. I'm 87, I'm not so sure anymore. Well, wait a minute.
The sideburns and the missing teeth might have been too much.
The sideburns we held back, but the missing teeth we put as fake teeth in.
So what was the critical reaction?
Well, the critical thing with the film was quite extraordinary. These films, this kind of film, lived and died with one critic in New York, a guy named Bosley Crowther. And Bosley Crowther was really a fine critic, but he deplored violence. And the film we opened, and we got extraordinary reviews in every newspaper in the city except the New York Times, and Crowther belted the hell out of us. And then that's following 6 or 8 months later, he did the same thing with
Bonnie and Clyde.
Bonnie and Clyde.
Cost him his job.
It finally cost him his job. He
was out of touch.
He was totally out of touch and didn't. And, you know, we talked about the violence. Well, the film is inherent violence. In the active violence, there's the mugging at the beginning and the fight at the end. And the fight at the end, the censors kept me to, I think, 20 or 21 seconds. You cannot have more than 21 or 22, literally, seconds. So we had to clock it so that we could not go past that certain point. That's how careful they were watching us. So it was very, very rigid and very strict. But he really hurt us. He hurt us a lot. Because the East Side theaters depended on his review to bring people in. And it was very, very tough.
But this opened in Times Square.
We opened
at the Victoria?
We opened at the Victoria in Times Square, and I was at the opening. And it was one of the most terrifying experiences of my whole life. We were in the theater, and it was a very mixed audience, and there was quite a large African-American portion of the audience there. And as the film progressed, as I've learned afterwards, African-American audiences become very involved in the piece, and they begin to verbalize and talk and carry on. And with this film, that didn't happen. They sat there very quietly until the scene when the police come in and bust Brock. And at that point, I became terrified. They began to stamp on the floor and stand up and bang the walls, those who were sitting on the side of the theater. This rumbling roar filled the theater. I really got very frightened, and I ran out. I didn't know what the hell. I really didn't know what the hell was going to happen. It was an extraordinary experience. The audiences seemed to like it. But as I said, we got hurt by the Crowther review, and
but it didn't hurt your career.
No, it didn't. No, my career, thank goodness, was very lucky.
You went on to make one of your biggest hits,
yeah,
only
I made Goodbye Columbus
right after, and the yeah. other side of the mountain.
Yeah, but it was
which
a very
you're still living off, I hear.
Well, yeah, I yeah. am actually. Yeah, thank God. I had. You asked why I picked a film like that. I have what you'd call very eclectic tastes in material. My first film was One Potato, Two Potato. My second film was The Incident. My third film was Goodbye Columbus. So there's quite a span and different kind of material that carried. But that's who I am. So you see what you got.
Well, I called you in L.A. a mensch. They didn't know what I was talking about. But you are a mensch and a great guy. And really great having you here tonight. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.